Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, brought to you from the Cubberley Community Center in Palo Alto, California. My name is Melinda Thomas, and I'll be your chair for this evening's event. We would like to welcome the listeners of WXXI AM 1370 in Rochester, New York, one of the 225 stations joining us nationwide for America's longest-running radio program. It's my great pleasure to introduce Martin Amis, author of such fearless and funny literary juggernauts as London Fields, Money, and Heavy Water. In addition to being a world-class writer, Mr. Amis is also a close friend and mentee of Saul Bellow, and the son of the late Kingsley Amis. This list is by no means exhaustive, but it's enough to bring us to his new memoir, Experience, recently described by the New York Times as a book that fuses his humor, intellect, and daring with a new gravitas and warmth, a book that stands at once as a loving tribute to his father and as a fulfillment of his own abundant talents as a writer. In his 26-year career, Mr. Amis has aroused as much controversy as he has love and admiration. Yet throughout the ups and downs, the critical lambasting and fawning, Mr. Amis has maintained a sense of dignity that reaches its culmination in the subject of tonight's presentation, Experience. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Martin Amis.
Good evening, and thank you all very much for coming. How nice it is to see your expectant faces. I'm going to read something I haven't read before. I need to set it up by reading this earlier passage. I'm talking about my love life in my mid-20s, which was pretty typical for the time. This would have been mid-70s. Now, one of the briefest of these affairs, one of the most condensed in time, caused me to pay another visit to my mother not long after her reluctant return to England in 1977. I said I had a story I wanted to tell her and a photograph I wanted to show her. "Yes, dear," she said. "Nearly 3 years ago," I said, "I had an affair with a young woman called Lamorna. She had been and still was married to a rather older man, Patrick, whom I had known slightly for some time. Patrick and Lamorna," I continued, "had not been getting on well. Their marriage at that time was chaste." "Yes, dear," said my mother. I said, "She talked about her daughter, and then there was the photograph, Mum." She gave me the photograph. "Yes, dear. It was ready in my pocket. It showed a 2-year-old girl in a dark flower dress, smocked at the chest, with short puffed sleeves and pink trim. She had fine blonde hair. Her smile was demure, pleased, but quietly pleased." My mother snatched the photograph from my hand. "Lamorna," I said, "says I'm her father. What do you think, Mum?" She held the photograph at various distances from her eyes. She held it at arm's length, her free hand steadying her glasses. She brought it closer. Without looking up, she said, "Definitely." This is from the second half of the book. It's called The Main Events. There's a nice little bit about you in here. When I asked my mother, I said, "What should I do, Mom?" And she said, "Don't do anything, dear. It's not your place to do anything. She's being well looked after. Don't do anything," she said. Now we go ahead 20 years. It was the late spring of 1995, and I had just returned from a 3-week book tour of North America. On such tours, Ian McEwan once said, "You feel like the employee of a former self." Because the book is now out there to be championed while you have moved on. Well, my book, The Information, was still with me. Was too much with me, soon and late. But I won't tender any further complaints about the book tour. Some writers find the role of the double, because that's what you have to do, you have to double. More degrading, deracinating, boring, tiring, and so on than others find it. Some writers are not easily divisible and must cloister themselves behind moats and barbed wire. Once an outrageous novelty, the book tour is now accepted as a fact of life. You arrive in each city and present yourself to its media. After that, in the evening, a mediated individual, you appear at the bookshop and perform. And now something salutary happens. As you are confronted by your most priceless asset, your readers. How badly you need them, because they know who you really are. They are the confidants of your unconscious mind. It does the author good to meet the reader. Sometimes in the signing queue, I see a pair of eyes quietly telling me that communion has occurred, and I feel a proportional transfusion. I had come in on the overnight that spring morning. My plane, in addition, had peeled off for a rest stop in the Arctic and arrived 4 or 5 hours late. The après book tour condition, I think, would be indistinguishable from extreme jet lag, with or without the extreme jet lag that usually accompanies it. All split and scoured, the author, that not particularly fragile being, must now shed his executive self and repossess his former shape. It was a Sunday. I and my ghost were alone in the studio apartment. We had coffee, or I made it and my ghost drank it. He had a bath, sluicing off all that jumbo, and I felt a little better. We passed round a cigarette as I went through my mail. One letter caused me to sit down suddenly when I was halfway through its first sentence. This, I might have murmured to my ghost, is probably for you. That night, carrying the letter in my chest pocket, I escorted my wife to the Coronet in Notting Hill Gate, where we saw an awfully big adventure, the screen adaptation of Beryl Bainbridge's novel. And I'm very sorry, Beryl, but I slept through most of it, asleep both deep and fitful, and then walked out. We regrouped for dinner at that pizza pasta place just down the street. I took the letter from my jacket and passed it across the table. Isabel, my wife, finished reading it and said, "Good." "There isn't any reason, is there," I said, "why this shouldn't be a great thing?" "None," she said. I rang my mother in the morning and sent her mine back almost 20 years. She said immediately, "I still got the photograph." "Do you think you could dig it out, Mum?" "It's here on the dressing table," she said. And now it's on the shelf in the study within arm's reach of my desk. I felt it was important to tell the story in the simplest possible terms. My interlocutors, after all, were aged 11 and 10. Number one son, Louis. Number two son, Jacob. For the occasion, I had taken the boys to a Chinese restaurant called the Spice Market, prized by them at the time for its serve-yourself and all-you-can-eat facilities. What I was about to reveal to them was a family matter, a private matter, but I knew it couldn't remain private. There was a feeling among my intimates that I should wait, that the boys weren't ready for the news. But it seemed to me that I didn't have a choice. To give the emphasis, my free will was being compromised. The newspapers weren't going to care whether or not the boys were ready. Over and above this, though, I thought that the boys were ready, had always been ready. I trusted the morality of my sons. "There was once a little girl," I said. I said, "I'm going to tell a story. There was once a little girl called Delilah. She had a brother and a mother and a father. When she was 2 years old, her mother died. Her mother killed herself. She hanged herself. Delilah grew up with her brother, raised by her father, who remarried. Then, when she was 18, it was revealed that her father wasn't her real father. And so suddenly it seemed that she had no parents at all." Louis and Jacob spoke in one voice. They had a habit that night of speaking in one voice. "Poor her," they said. "Well, boys," I said, "the real father is me." "Good," they said. And we talked on. Good, good, it seemed good. The meeting was set for 7 o'clock in the bar of a Knightsbridge hotel called the Rembrandt, a potent name and a challenging spirit for students of the human face. And very soon, two human faces would be opposed, as in a mirror, each addressing the other with unprecedented curiosity. I arrived 20 minutes early, accompanied by an indispensable Isabel. My hands were shaking. They always shake, my hands, but that evening they felt quite disconnected from me. A cup and saucer would sound like a pair of castanets in my grip. An iced drink would become a maraca. We sat on a sofa among lamps and low tables, doilies, anti-macassars. I watched the door. She knew what I looked like. And I knew that she was 19 and would arrive on the very stroke of the hour. She entered. "It's you," said Isabel. Then hugs and kisses for the girl with my face. On the telephone the next day, Patrick, her other father, and I had a conversation of surrealistic urbanity. It felt likely that these sentences had never been heard before. I congratulated him on his daughter, and he congratulated me on mine. "Poor her," said the boys in one voice when they heard her story. "Good," they said, when I told them who the father was. "I'm very pleased and proud," I said, "that you've taken it this way." And very relieved, I might have added. But I don't think I felt any relief, because I didn't feel any doubt. And again, the eerie unison with the frowning duo saying, "Why would we not?" Yes, exactly, why would you not? And when, a day or two later, Delilah came to dinner for the first time, the boys leapt to the sound of the buzzer and ran upstairs to open the door and let her in. 6 weeks later, I went to pick up Louis from one of his guitar lessons. Hey, what happened to those guitar lessons? And we looked into a newsagent's for a comic or a football magazine. The Daily Express had Delilah and me on its front page. I don't often use the adverb wryly, but that is how he said it. More bad publicity, Daddy? I don't know, maybe not, I said. Without acknowledgement, I quoted his grandfather at him on the correspondences between cruelty and sentimentality. I said, "The papers have only got two ways to go," I said, "and I think they'll be playing this one as a heart warmer." "Jesus, still," said Louis. "I know," I said. Delilah was in a safe place, or at least a distant one, and would be away for 3 months. But then the Express sent their journalist after her to Quito, Ecuador. Delilah cooperated. It was our policy, formulated by Patrick, to cooperate. And the subsequent article wore an indulgent smile. All the coverage was like that. It beamed fondly on us. No doubt it was Delilah's youth, her manifest innocence and vulnerability that softened the mood. I was very glad that they hadn't tried to hurt her, but I sat through it all in the way that one tolerates, counting one's immediate blessings, the tearful interlude of a notoriously violent drunk. Our story did the rounds of the dailies and then was picked up for more thoughtful treatment at the weekend. Then came another revelation. In his essay on the old curiosity shop, G.K. Chesterton talks about the kind of criticism or commentary that makes a writer jump out of his boots. Such an occurrence is vanishingly rare. 9 out of 10 writers, I imagine, get through life without once experiencing it. But it does happen, and it happened to me. In the Sunday Observer, the novelist Maureen Freely staged a straightforward retrospective of my fiction and noted the punctual arrival, just in time for my third novel, Success, 1978, of a stream of lost or wandering daughters and putative or fugitive fathers, and that these figures recurred with variations in every subsequent book. There was nothing I could do about this diagnosis. It chimed with something Patrick had said during our first talk on the telephone. He said, "I expect it's been in the back of your mind." Yes, exactly, in the back of my mind. Your writing comes from the back of your mind, where thoughts are unformulated and anxiety is silent. That's where it comes from, silent anxiety. I felt that there was something almost embarrassing about the neatness and obviousness of Maureen Freely's interpretation. But it also sharply consoled me because it meant that I had been with Delilah in spirit far more than I knew. The interpretation is incomplete. There is at least one other eidolon, one other ghost idealized and feared for. A yard from my right shoulder stands the transparent picture frame containing the two photographs back to back of Delilah Seal, 2 years old, in the print dress, and my cousin Lucy Partington, bespectacled, school uniformed, sitting in a curtained booth. Now, Lucy disappeared in 1973, disappeared, and she was 21, and for a further 21 years, no one knew what had happened to her until she was exhumed from the basement of the house that the newspapers called the House of Horrors, the residence of one of England's most prolific serial murderers. And there is a third presence, a third absence, Delilah's mother, Lamorna, who hanged herself in 1978. I find I have written a great deal about and around suicide. Suicide, the most somber of all subjects, the saddest story. It awakens terror and pity in me, yet it compels me. It compels my writing hand. Perhaps because what I do all day and what they do, the suicides in an instant are so close to being antithetical. Chesterton, again, said that suicide was a heavier undertaking than murder. The murderer kills just one person. The suicide kills everybody. And what other submerged memory had me going downstairs yesterday to look for a certain novel that after 13 pages confronted me with, quote, I saw now how conventional were my former ideas on pre-suicidal preoccupations. A man who has decided upon self-destruction is far removed from mundane affairs, and to sit down and write his will would be, at that moment, an act just as absurd as winding up one's watch, since, together with the man, the whole world is destroyed. The last letter is instantly reduced to dust, and with it, all the postmen. And like smoke vanishes the estate bequeathed to a non-existent progeny. Unquote. All the postmen, that is genius. I feel a strong and consistent resistance to the harshness of Chesterton's great formulation. Nabokov, moral, but not moralistic, the novel is The Eye by Nabokov, is more painfully persuasive. Suicide is on the side, but it's not in me to pass any judgment on it. It escapes morality. Throughout history, suicide has been arduously detaching itself from human censure, the curses and penalties, the rock-heaped graves in unsanctified ground, the defiled cadavers. Why drive a stake through their hearts when, as James Joyce knew, their hearts have been broken already? In the novel Night Train, I had my woman narrator make the following observation. Quote, it used to be said not so long ago that every suicide gave Satan special pleasure. I don't think that's true, unless it isn't true either that the devil is a gentleman. Unquote. But the devil is not a gentleman. The gentle do come to grief. And when Satan in Paradise Lost sets out from Pandemonium, abode of all demons, this was his mission. To waste his whole creation, to confound the race of mankind in one root, and earth with hell, to mingle and involve. Suicides, too, are world killers. They are, in that critical moment, every man and every woman. But no blame attaches. If what she was suffering had been endurable, then she would have endured. Delilah was a two-year-old standing on the stairs. Her older brother, Orlando, who led the way, could see the hanging body, and it was Patrick who had to go in and take her down. That void world up there is, of course, the central fact behind Delilah's origin and evolution, and not the little mystery of the lost found father, which is good, good, only good. No mother, but more than one father now, and much else. It does go on. When the revelation came, Delilah forfeited technical consanguinity with her half-brother and half-sister. But there were two more, a half-brother and another half-brother, waiting like a team, just as they wait for the sound of the buzzer and then run upstairs to let her in. "What do you think, Mum?" I said as she snatched the photograph in my hand. "Definitely." "What should I do?" "Nothing. Don't do anything, dear." I had always wanted a girl, and suddenly there she was in the Rembrandt, like a mirror. For 17 years, I had been worrying about her in the back of my mind. Time, thus affronted, I thought, would give us work to do, but it hasn't been like that. Love flowed and was soon declared, and now she and I can say the words in unison. Why would it not? Just want to end with a little coda to that story. This is November 1996. When I told Salman Rushdie about Delilah, he said, "So she's at Oxford now. She's already at Oxford." I said, "She was, second year." He said, "Quite an interesting way of doing it. Skip the nappy stage, the diaper stage, and go straight to gowns and mortarboards." Exactly. Now, I was expecting another baby at this time. I calmed myself, I was 47, by whimsically elaborating on this way of doing it, the Oxford alternative, the emeritus alternative, in which the father's title is merely honorary. This accounted for the fact that we were having the baby at St. Mary's, so convenient for Paddington Station. As soon as the baby was born, I would pack it off to Oxford. I knew the plan contained a flaw. I didn't expect to be all that surprised when the call came through saying that the baby was unable to read or write or walk or talk and was permanently in tears. The truth was that I was ready for another child. I was in training for another child. But I made no secret of my longing for a girl. Although I now had Delilah, I had not raised Delilah, and I wanted to raise a girl. I was desperate to see how the other half live. When my first son was born, I wanted a girl, but I was quick to take his point, traditionalist though it was, about starting off with a boy. When my second son was born, I wanted a girl, and it took me several minutes to forgive him for not being a daughter. All my life I wanted a girl. Even when I was a boy, I wanted a girl. At St. Mary's, I had been wondering off and on whether the baby would arrive in time to make the 4 o'clock to Oxford. But the joke was definitely over well before parturition. Earlier, for a full minute, the baby's heart had stopped beating. And from then on, all thoughts were primitive and choric, just a steady whine for mercy. But my faith in the cunning of babies was strong. I knew that in this process they were neither passive nor disinterested. They did mean to live, to persist. Both the boys had come early, dangerously early, and they had persisted. The new baby had gone to term and would be even better prepared, even more resourceful and resolute and sly. In the delivery room, there was now an atmosphere of industrious crisis management. Auxiliaries, a pediatrician, two more midwives stood ready as the Venteurs, the suction instrument, was decisively applied. Dr. Marwood parted the baby's thighs with a matador's flourish. I took this in, But what riveted me more was the lower lip, which was still trembling as if in an attempt to resist tears. Well, it had been a difficult journey through all kinds of freak weather. After a while, I took the hot sole next door to be washed, weighed, measured, and tagged, and to receive the prefatory installment of administered pain in the thigh from the nurse's needle. Our first visitor the next day was Delilah. On her way up, she had stopped at the in-house florist's on the ground floor. She said, "When she was wrapping the flowers, the woman asked me, 'Nephew or niece?' What did you tell her?" Delilah's words made me happy, but they also made me realize how many days and nights I had spent on the planet. "No sister," I said, "sister." Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Amos, for sharing your memoirs with us. Now I'd like to introduce Josh Emmons, who will cover our question-answer period. Mr. Emmons is the editor of The Commonwealth, our organization's weekly newsletter. He has been an admirer of Mr. Amos's writing for several years and will be leaving soon to pursue a writing fellowship at the renowned Ira Writers Workshop.
Thank you, Melinda, very much. And now, Mr. Amos, if you could rise and return to the podium. We have a large number of questions. So to begin, in Experience, you list the works for which Kingsley Amos, your father, will hopefully be remembered. If you did the same for yourself, what would they be and why?
Your books are like your children in that you shouldn't have favorites. Or if you do, you should shut up about it. And that's what I'm going to do on this.
Very good. You've said somewhere, I think in visiting Mrs. Nabokov, or perhaps the information, that one of your favorite comics is of two little boys in a playground, one of whom taunts the other by saying, "My dad has moved further to the right than yours." How do you account for the ideological divide, you being liberal and he conservative, between you and Kingsley?
My father, Kingsley Amis, was, I used to say to him, you know, you're the hysteric when it comes to politics, and I'm the steady one, because he used to be a communist. He was a communist throughout the war, as many people were. He was Comrade Amis at Oxford, and Iris Murdoch was Comrade Murdoch. They were all at it. Then he became, in the pattern of his generation, he became more and more right-wing, more and more noisily right-wing. I account for it, this is perhaps doing him an injustice, but I account for it as follows, that he was the first, he came from low middle-class background, he was the first in his tribe, in his brood, to go to university. Then he became successful and had, things to defend. He had a position and a big house and naturally became less political, which really means becoming conservative. And then he just used to do it for fun, I think, and particularly to wind me up, to get me going. I mean, I used to have ridiculous arguments where he was, about Nelson Mandela, where he would say that he was a terrorist and murderer and, you know, ought to be locked up for the rest of his life. And when Kingsley's letters were there to be gone through, I expected it to be full of, unspeakable right-wing opinions, because he loved annoying the politically correct, the bien-pensant. And in fact, there's hardly anything there that that seems unreasonable, which convinces me that it was... He used to say to me, "You're a leaf in the wind of trend." And that's why I think he used to sort of stir me up.
Can you elaborate on the experience footnote about Salman Rushdie and Don DeLillo going to a baseball game together? Did you ever visit Brother Teresa in Calcutta with Christopher Hitchens?
I can't elaborate on the Don DeLillo, Salman Rushdie story. Although, you know, these spectral novelists who hide away and are never seen and create a lot of mystery around themselves are much more approachable than you think. And Ian McEwan used to have lunch regularly with Thomas Pynchon. The other question, did I go to Calcutta?
To see Mother Teresa with Christopher Hitchens.
No, I let the hitch go by himself.
Just because Christopher Hitchens wrote a book called The Missionary Position, in which he slams Mother Teresa for her various hypocrisies. But anyway, can you talk about what you're working on now? Rumor has it that it's a novel about pornography and the British royal family, and that Prince Charles is advising you on several key details.
I always thought Christopher should have called that book Holy Cow. what am I working on now? Well, actually, I'm writing a political memoir about my father's politics that then becomes an attempt at amateur historiography, and it's about the Russian experience in the early 20th century, and it's an attempt to open a debate which says that that experience should be elevated a bit closer to the Jewish Holocaust, that there should be far more taint and dread associated with it than there is now. This will be a pamphlet-length thing, about 70 pages. The novel I'm writing about is about, does have a theme of pornography and paedophilia, and does involve the royal family. It's not this royal family, it's a sort of parallel universe royal family, and there's a king, and he's Henry the Ninth. And I used to, actually I used to hang out with Prince Charles. I had two dinners with him in a little party of five, because he liked humorists, and there's a very funny Australian writer called Clive James, you might have heard of, and Prince Charles used to fraternize with him, so I was in on that. He's rather sweet, actually, Prince Charles. And he has one of those aristocratic laughs that he goes, ha ha ha.
Your veneration of Vladimir Nabokov and Saul Bellow is no secret. How do they continue to inform your thoughts about literature?
Well, who was it who said, was it Eliot who said, young writers are influenced by other writers. Older writers steal from other writers. It's sort of beyond the point now where I feel influenced by those two. Although I, you know, obviously deeply have been influenced by them, but it more feels like they're inspiring figures, inspirational figures, and if I get stuck with a scene or a description, I only have to think for a while how they would do it, and that's usually enough. They're like, you know, they sort of, you feel as though they're you know, cheering you on, much as you get that same feeling from your readers. They're cheering on a one-man team.
Do e-books and the possible murder of intellectual property rights by the internet upset you, especially given the story of Stephen King's Riding the Bullet being sold exclusively over the net in an encrypted, uncopyable program that was hacked within 24 hours and posted for free?
It's getting beyond the point now where one can talk about the inviolability of the book and, you know, what a marvelous thing it is, what a marvelous object it is, because, and this I've always believed till this weekend, where in California people have told me that they did an experiment with e-books on various academics, and the academics said they love the e-books. Clearly, there is nothing irreplaceable about the book, and the e-book will become a fact of life. How the economics of this is going to work, I don't know. And if books are suddenly published free, then it's not so bad for me, but it means the death of the novel and the death of the poem, because how is anyone going to get started? I think I keep trying to bring all the modern themes together in my mind, but it's also slippery and fluid that one can't. But it seems to me that everything is being democratized now. This is the final democratizations are occurring. On the internet, everyone's a critic. Very soon, everyone will be a writer, everyone will be a novelist. Everyone will be famous. It's not the case, as Andy Warhol said, that in the future, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes. In the future, everyone will be famous all the time, but only in their own heads. It's a sort of karaoke fame. I'll have to just deal with this as it comes at me. I imagine the internet will have to be policed in some way. I know I will keep on writing, even if I don't get paid for it. I think what will happen, my prediction is that writers won't get paid for their books if this does happen, but they'll be given something like sort of $10,000 a night to go to people's dinner parties, and maybe $20,000 to be someone's friend for a week.
So what is the secret of your success with women? You say you're a cad, and yet I counted relationships with 11 fashionable and well-connected women.
That really is the tip of the iceberg. I'm going to take this up in future when people, as I always get asked, why do the press hate you so much? And I say, I'm tired of saying I don't understand it. I'm tired of saying I don't understand it. But from now on, I'm going to go with this theory that extraordinary success with women is what creates all this bad feeling.
This is very simple. Why do Americans lack irony?
I don't think they do lack irony. I think that's a myth. And, the supposedly drill, chortling English are often impervious to irony. I've always felt that people get me much better over here than they do in England. And I think that Americans instinctively have more respect for writers, too, because they knew that that America in its birth and formation had to define itself, had to discover what it was. Was it a collection of Germans, Italians, Jews, Irish, etc., with no common being, or was it a country, a nation with a heart and a soul? And I think everyone knew that this big job was belonged to the writers, and even if not consciously, I think every American feels that.
This may be somewhat of a belated follow-up to the Bello Nabokov question, but Will Self has said that every writer under the age of 40 wishes that he or she were you, presumably in England at least. What gratifies you and or worries you most about your iconic status vis-a-vis young writers?
That nothing worries me about it. It's imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. I think there's a kind of kill the father thing that goes along with that, which isn't perhaps so welcome. They did a survey among, I think, 8 young writers to say what they thought of me. About 3 of them said, he's no good and passé and all that. And 5 said that they did copy me or at least like my stuff. And I found praise from the younger writers was actually delightful. And one of them said something that that still gives me a kick. A couple of months later, he said that when I was growing up in a sort of nothing town, my novels, you know, showed him a world, excited him, encouraged him. And he ended, "Mr. Amis, I wish you a long life. And thanks, man," he said. And I think that really gave me a kick.
Your experience with the lowercase e, writing the movie Saturn III, is brilliantly satirized in your 1984 novel Money, as are Hollywood mores in the short story Career Move. Has your view of the industry softened during production of the movie adaptation of an earlier work, Dead Babies?
It's true they have made this film, and it's you know, very energetic and exciting film too. But I you're a wage slave when you write for the movies, and you have to do what you never do as a novelist, which is think about the market. And you think about the market because you're writing a science fiction film, and suddenly Lethal Weapon 3 comes out, and then someone from upstairs comes down and says, "We've got to have a black guy and a white guy who are buddies in this science fiction." I mean, you really are a leaf in the wind of market forces there. Also, you're dependent on you know, every imaginable inadvertency, as well as working collaboratively with all these other people. Whereas, you know, the novelist bestrides his universe like a colossus, and is in control not only of the actors and the locations, but also the crowds and the weather.
Your discussion of Kingsley's alcoholism in Experience is very candid, as is the occasional allusion to your own smoking dope. What connection do you suppose there is, if any, between getting high and writing?
Well, let's put an end to that alcoholism. If you look at the page in my father's books that says by the same author, there's hardly room for another entry. His letters before abridgment ran to something like 2,000 pages, and their most consistent theme was self-reproach for laziness. Alcoholics don't write 30 novels. They don't have a collected poems and, you know, a dozen other nonfiction books. He was a heavy drinker, but he would always, you know, get up at 9, and he would be in there no matter how he felt. That was his rhythm. There's a whole section on this in my book, and I say that you know, the writer's life is a kind of uneasy mixture of anxiety and ambition, which are the same thing, really, because what you're trying to do is do right by your talent and write the books that you were sent here to write, and that is your primary duty. So you'd be wanting to get a relief from that if you can, and, you know, getting high was certainly what he had in mind. There was never anything namby-pamby about, you know, the quest for the immediate effects of alcohol. And in one of his novels, the narrator Bowen says that if he ever took up brewing of beer, he would have a big ad for his beer, which would say Bowen's beer, and then it would have a picture of his mother-in-law falling over and drinking a lot of it, and underneath, makes you drunk.
Do you find yourself mimicking or consciously veering from the parental model you grew up with in Kingsley?
I sometimes recognize certain argumentative styles that my father had, and I recognize that in myself, and I try to combat it. I mean, your parents teach you by example, by negative example, and by positive example. And my father taught me a lot on the positive side, but, you know, you keep an eye out for the negative things, because in age, your worst qualities try very hard to recrudesce and take over, and you have to fight them. And you know, your dad is a pretty good trailer for what's going to happen to you. And if you're an observant son, you'll know what to look out for.
You've written a lot in both novels and nonfiction about the nuclear reality. So what do you think of the rekindled interest by American congresspeople in the Strategic Defense Initiative, a.k.a. Star Wars? Might you be writing London Fields 2 soon?
Well, this is an enormous subject. And, you know, I would have said that this SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative, is the old Reagan fantasy of the nuclear umbrella, etc. But there seems to be we're in a completely different era now from the one I was writing about. We're not in the age of mutual assured destruction. We're in the age of proliferation. I'm pleased that finally Clinton has thought that he might salvage his presidency by cobbling something together with Russia. But that huge moral capital we had in 89 when, and through to 91 when the Soviet Union collapsed and Gorbachev had made those zero deals with Reagan, there was enormous capital there that should have been, you know, powered through. And Jonathan Schell talks about virtual deterrence, where you, instead of having nuclear war as a heartbeat away, which was the arrangement until 89 at least, you have it so that it's 6 months away. You have to find a crisis stable answer to these things, because everything else was very vulnerable to crisis. So if you have your weapons 6 months from being active, you need to assemble them, the chances are that that the crisis has blown over and you have time to think straight.
Okay, following up with another political question. Your essay on the 1988 Republican National Convention is justly famous. Any thoughts on this year's presidential race with another George Bush?
Yes, I was down there in New Orleans when Bush unleashed Dan Quayle. And we went into a sort of caucus meeting, and Dan Quayle looked as though he'd just done about 10 grams of coke. And he got up there while Bush looked on fondly. He got up there and said, "The task facing this country is whether we're going to move on to the future or pass to the back." He had attempted a miserable cliche and even messed that up. I'm looking forward to, you know, I spend the summer in America and I read the New York Times every day. And I'm looking forward to getting interested in this election. So far, I immeasurably prefer Gore. What sticks in my mind about Bush, you know, just as when Clinton broke off his campaigning to go back and execute that brain-damaged murderer Ricky Ray Rector, the one who asked if he could save his dessert for later when they let him off. Everyone then was talking about Jennifer Flowers. And when George Bush executed Carla Faye Tucker in Texas, everyone was talking about Monica Lewinsky. What disgusts me most about that Carla Faye Tucker episode is that George Bush said he prayed for guidance on the issue, and the answer was a lowered thumb.
What rituals or methods do you have to enter into a good writing frame of mind, or do you use to enter?
The key to all writing is solitude, and the writer is that being who is most alive when alone. Being alone is the best preparation for writing, and You know, you have to, you can go into your study and nothing much will happen all day. You'll just read or, you know, pick your nose. But the hours you spend in there by yourself are necessary hours, even if you write not a syllable.
Following up, what inspiration sources do you look to in your fiction writing? Someone mentions London Fields and Times Arrow in particular.
You can't write. I mean, you when you're stuck, you wonder how other writers might do it, how Bellow or Nabokov or Dickens indeed might do it, but it's very mysterious how it all works. And you know, whenever anyone asks me, they say, "Why did you decide in Time's Arrow to do it backwards in time?" It never is a decision. There are plenty of decisions in writing. There are a couple of hundred every page. This word, that word, colon, semicolon. But the big decisions are all made by the unconscious. And Nabokov describes it as a throb. He said the first throb of Lolita went through me when, and he explains. And that's really what it feels like. You trust your body more than is commonly understood. And if something doesn't feel right, if it's making you feel uneasy, then you know something's wrong. My father used to have to go through this ritual when something was wrong. He'd have to take himself by the hand, sort of mentally, and say, "Now what is it? What's troubling you?" And he'd say, "It's something to do with the first page." And then they'd go into the study together and fix it. But I don't have any ritual of quite that kind. My father used to worry every day. I only worry as I'm finishing. All the anxiety is saved up till then. But, you know, in the end, the anxiety has to be there. The novel would be no good without it, and it's part of what you put into it.
So Salman Rushdie and his girlfriend have recently moved to New York, and there are some rumors that you are planning to relocate there from London. In what ways would you like your children to be American versus British and vice versa?
Well, four of my five children are half American anyway, because my first wife was American and my second wife was American. That's up to them, which they're going to be. And I would, you know, no more urge them one way or the other than I would urge them to become writers. I myself want to come eventually to live in America because purely for artistic reasons, just for stimulus. I mean, England's great, but it's so evolved now. It's like a, you know, an efficiency state. It's like Switzerland. And America is, as we see, still convulsed in fascinating ways. You don't really want to live in... If you were a citizen, and just a citizen, you would like to live in a very evolved country with not very pressing social problems. But as a writer, you want to live here where the future is being test-driven and where... You know, all sorts of barbaric things remain as well, like the death penalty.
So what do you think of young writers coming up in both England and the United States? Zadie Smith was in San Francisco recently and said that she avidly consumes both your and your father's work. Have you read White Teeth?
I met Zadie Smith the first time. I think she's wonderful. I haven't read her book yet, but I will. But the truth is that younger writers are very irritating to older writers. And I, you know, was irritated Kingsley a lot by being a younger writer. It's natural to admire elders and to be suspicious of your youngers. And Kingsley and I formulated it once where we said, yes, because the young writer is saying to the old writer, it's not like that anymore, it's like this. And that and this refer to rhythms of thought, to to the way people think now. A heartening example to us all is Saul Bellow, whose marvelous last novel, Ravelstein, shows that even in your mid-80s, you can still be attuned to the rhythms of thought, even though you're, you know, so far advanced from it. And I think that novel is the first of perhaps several that we'll see from our writers. You know, I don't think anyone's written a terrific novel at the age of 84 before, and that book seems to me to have a kind of tremulous, crystallized beauty that the world has never known. So that's another first.
So this question says, I felt that your father was a very powerful influence in your life. Was experience in some ways your personal tribute to him?
Very much so. I couldn't have written this book without when he was alive. I would have had no interest in doing it, although I always knew I would write about him when he was dead because of the rarity of our case, that it was more or less a pro bono duty. But that is the main impulse behind the book. It's we were, like everyone else, we were very peculiar, and our case is very peculiar, but it's also just another instance of a father and a son, and it's universal, just as all our lives are universal. It's dependent on the ordinary miracles and the ordinary disasters, which are births, deaths, and separations.
Well, thank you very much, and it looks like we've come to that point in our program where we have time for just one more question. So you've written very incisively about Madonna before, when her book Sex came out. Is there anything in particular that the world should note about Britney Spears? And as one last, somebody asks what exactly your politics are. Are you a middle-aged fogey or an aging leftist, in California terms?
Neither, because I was never very left. I am left of center, just a little bit left of center, which seems to be the only position that isn't crankish, really. Funny enough, it was my father who veered around the wings of politics. I'm a humble centrist. I'm sure I'll be called an old fogey because I'm writing something that is very anti-communist. And there's always this assumption that if you take up one position, you're taking up the whole package. It isn't like that. And what I'm interested in here is just refining the truth a little bit.
Well, thanks, Rick. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Again, we'd like to thank Mr. Martin Amis, author of Experience and Memoir, Mr. Josh Emmons, editor of The Commonwealth, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley, is adjourned.